podcast CoMusic.
Today we are in CoMusic podcast season 9 episode 2. We are with Moisés Horta Valenzuela alias Exorcismos. Can you introduce yourself please and tell us a little bit about your work?
Hi, Lluvia and Berta. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Moisés Horta Valenzuela, and I'm an artist, a technologist, and researcher working with electronic music, generative artificial intelligence, and generally researching these new technologies that make use of generative artificial neural networks, both in my work as a musician and also as workshops for people who want to learn more about these technologies. I've been working in music for the past 15 years now. My background started experimenting with more noise kinds of music, mostly using computer music back in 2006 or around that time. And this brought me to start a band in around 2009, where I was part of for about 6 years in Mexico, in my city of Tijuana, where this band, we were exploring electronic music at the intersection of traditional music making, so like traditional vernacular genres of Latin American music, such as the local genres of regional Mexican music and beyond from Latin America, and incorporating them with electronic music and different styles of music, such as electronic music, noise music, and sound art. I was part of this band from 2009 to 2015. And after that, my alias Exorcismos, which is my current alias as a musician, it started as a parallel to this band where I wanted to explore more algorithmic music making and specifically machine learning for music, which is a field of computer science that makes use of artificial neural networks, which are algorithms that learn by examples of data to create new instruments. In this period from 2015 onwards, I've been focusing on developing my work as Exorcismos, which has taken me to start experimenting way more with artificial neural networks, deep learning more recently, and what you would generally call artificial intelligence. There's this side of my project. Yeah, so a lot of this work has been done as a way, autodidact kind of way, where I try to engage with these new technologies from a critical perspective. So talking about generative systems that learn from data, or generative music systems that learn from data, I try to work with them from a perspective of understanding how these systems are working down to the level of the algorithm, and at the same time experiment with different styles of music that are rarely found in this type of field, such as traditional club musics that emerge from Latin America, or what you would say the Global South, as a way to decenter the narrative of these algorithms generally designed for music for the Global North. So I take it upon myself to train these algorithms on very different styles of music that are not usually found in this kind of research, and incorporate them in my own practice as a AI music researcher. And this has led me to create a couple of albums that make use of these technologies. One of them that explored generative music with deep learning or AI algorithms is an album called Transfiguración, which was self-released in 2020. And this album was more or less created as a way to see if you could use voice conversion algorithms, which are algorithms that make use of artificial neural networks that basically transform one style of music into another. So for this album, I was working with an old album from an artist called Antonio Cepeda that he released in 1972 called Templo Mayor, which means the main temple or the major temple, which is a reference to the ancient Aztec sacred site in what is now known as Mexico City. It's an acoustic album that features a lot of indigenous Mexica instrumentation and sounds And I wanted to explore how do you bring these types of rhythms that are ancient Mexica or that are actually reinterpretations Mexica culture into experimentation and into a sort of dialogue or tension with these new types of algorithms such as deep learning. So for this album, I was working with this data set of Antonio Cepeda's, but the idea was not to recreate or mimic the style of his playing. He's a percussionist, so I didn't really want to mimic the sonorities of him. But rather, I used an algorithm that actually uses two data sets. One of them is the source data set. In this case, it was Antonio Cepeda's album. And the target data set would be how the algorithm reconstructs the source data set. And the data set that I used, or the data that I used for this, was my own music. So the album, in a way, is a kind of reinterpretation mediated by the algorithm. Yeah, as a way to reenact or to recreate this type of music in the style of my own music. I saw it as a way to engage with these types of algorithm and with this idea of the style, like these patterns of the style, and how you would say these kinds of ways that one makes music, one is maybe not aware of. So all the different patterns and the commonalities of how I've been making music for the past 7 years, they can be analyzed by these types of algorithms and create a sort of mirror image using these technologies. I saw this technology as a way to explore issues of temporality, so like ancient music making or ancient sonorities with more contemporary sounds, and as a way to explore my own music making patterns and textures that I employ in my own music. We'll be right back.
how do you work or perceive the repetition and connect this kind of ritualization of the repetition? Can you explain your creative process in that matter? And also, why Exorcismus, the name?
I mean, the name is something that I kind of came up with. Gibbs evocates this idea of the spirits, right? So like an exorcism is when you take out some kind of bad spirits in this Christian cultural canon that is possessed. The exorcism is something that is possessing a body, and that somehow you want to take out this bad spirit, no? So it's signaling towards this idea of taking out some kind of evil or some kind of like dispossessed version through algorithms. So in this way, like exorcismos also is signaling towards the codes and like to the hexadecimal approach to music and to digital music. So that's kind of where it comes from. It's a bit of a play on words. So I guess like this idea of the ritualization, I've always been quite interested in both in the, as a very big fan and also maker of like cumbia music, which is a style of music that is present in most parts of Latin America, what is known as Latin America, or indigenously known as Abya Yala. And I find this genre of music very interesting, especially because of its roots with African music and how this type of Afro music gets into Latin America through migration and through contexts of like colonization. This genre takes a mind of its own, if you will. So I see like cumbia or these types of music that in their initial parts, if you look at the history, these were quite connected to the idea of a ritual or like a collective ritual, where these types of rhythms were connected to the sacred and through repetition evoke a sense of trance to the listener as a way of sacred making practice. But now in the more contemporary sense, like cumbia is a parallel to what you would say techno music or these types of club music. And I find that cumbia, or like the universe that cumbia has become, as a sort of decolonial approach to what we now know as dance music. Obviously, like dance music is such a big world of styles from all over the world, but I find that cumbia as a genre has this kind of multi-dimensionality, and at the same time it's a very democratic rhythm that is very accessible to make, but at the same time it's a very deep style of music that you can get really, really into, and it has its own histories and lineages. I'm not trying to say that what I do right now is cumbia, but in the sense of like cumbia as a ritual making style of music is very interesting to me in my own kind of practice, and also as a technology of intelligence. So it's like, if you think about cumbia and these lineages and these histories, the music in itself is a way to preserve culture and a way to preserve certain types of thinking that are very in line with notions of resistance, especially in the face of hegemonic styles of music, I think, from Latin America. And I think this can be also something we can talk about, because I'm very curious to know from the Bolivian perspective, what is the perspective on cumbia as a technology of sound, let's say.
Black, it's good,
I wanted to ask a couple of questions about how you blend technology with the music itself. When you have a concert, for example, you use the music all recorded and you play it through the algorithms, or you play live music and you blend it with the algorithms, or what do you do?
For my concerts, more recently, I've been working not so much with... I'm very interested in the notion of sound synthesis and improvisation on the spot. I think this was an interest that came about when I moved to Berlin, to Europe, because I was exposed to a lot of improvisational music and electroacoustic music and these kind of practices. I found kind of interesting, given my background as a producer, like a producer of electronic music, that is a totally different process. I guess it has less to do with the live execution of the music and more about the editing, and there has a lot more to do with composing rather than live music execution. So I found live improvisation and these kind of experimental practices for live music very interesting. But at the same time, I always found them a bit lacking, especially a lot of the European perspectives on this, that this idea of the noise, which can be in a way like noise music or free improvisation, can be quite emancipatory or quote unquote revolutionary. In some kind of way, I find that this kind of music has become, at least from the academic perspective, actually quite conservative type of music, even though the roots of this type of music of free improvisation and experimental sound practices can be, like, at its roots were, let's say, quite innovative or progressive. Right now, in the state of things, I always found them quite rigid, you know, like there's already these cliches. I mean, I'm generalizing a lot, but if I kind of can elaborate on these arguments, I find the practice of like free improvisation quite revolutionary, but the execution can be quite limiting or quite conservative in the patterns that is being made, and also who is allowed to make this type of music, which is usually quite relegated to the academia or certain very niche circles of sound experimentation. So taking this kind of approach in my current live sets or my live performances, like concerts, because I'm working a lot with generative artificial neural networks, and for those that don't know what those are what people are calling now generative artificial intelligence, which it doesn't really have anything about intelligence, but you can call it generative artificial labor, if you want to call it in this way. Because essentially what these algorithms do is that they learn the patterns in a big archive of sound or media. It can be images, it can be text. I mean, the most popular example is ChatGPT. So this is a type of generative artificial intelligence. So I use these type of systems using very little data learned from archives of sound. So I have different models, you call them models, so different algorithms that have been trained on specific styles of music. And then for my live performances, I actually generate the music live. So it, like, these algorithms become somehow autonomous in the sense that they propose a sound. So they just like generate sound based on whatever music that you trained it on. And this sound is sort of mimicking or emulating the patterns in the existing archive. One of the big questions in artificial intelligence is how these algorithms are interpreting the data in this hidden latent space. So the latent space, you can think about it as the, I mean, and I'm using this term very loosely because I don't want to make it seem that this is a brain, but you can think about it as like, for example, you as a human or us as humans, let's say we listen to cumbia music and we have this idea of cumbia music, but the sound is not necessarily in our brains. It's just there is a representation of this sound in our brains or in our minds based on the connections that were formed through experience of listening to certain styles of music. So now we have these concepts of like what a cumbia is or what electronic music is. So we have these general ideas that are these hidden representations. We actually don't know what are the neurons that connect to give emergence to these sort of ideas. But rather, these sort of ideas are actually, you know, represented in the mind. And then from this representation, we can actually execute and create a new cumbia song or a new electronic music song based on these hidden representations. And with this sort of algorithms, it's a bit similar in the sense that you expose these algorithms or to a big archive of sound, and then these algorithms create a hidden representation that can be quite abstract, that you don't know exactly what this representation is, but it exists, and the algorithm can reconstruct or recreate this style or essence of a certain archive of audio or images or text. So this idea of the hidden representation is something that when you're working with these algorithms in live, you can steer them and you can modify this hidden representation to kind of explore how this algorithm represented the data sets that you trained it on. And then I improvise with this. So I'm kind of like changing the parameters, these hidden latent space parameters of the network, and then generating and creating a negotiation with what this algorithm actually learned the fact that these algorithms are non-deterministic, meaning that you know that if the algorithm was trained on a certain style of music, it's going to generate something that sounds very similar to that style of music. But the way that this algorithm is generating the music or the patterns that it generates are not fully understandable. So there, it's always a kind of improvisation with the algorithm. And I find this quite interesting for music making, because it proposes a certain sound and it becomes a negotiation or an improvisation into the quote unquote mind or this small brain of the artificial neural network. But again, I want to make very clear that these things are not brains. They're not thinking, if you would say, like we are. But these are the metaphors that I'm trying to use to kind of explain this.
How the idea of Semilla AI born, and about your experience in Iceland and how you construct this interface.
Semilla is a ongoing research project, is trying to develop interfaces for interacting with these artificial neural networks for sound synthesis. So, I mean, as you know, Berta, like these algorithms right now are mostly code-based, and the way to interact with them or to train them is mostly through text code, which can be quite practical for people who are practicing live coding and these types of sound practices. But for a musician that is more used to the interfaces of synthesizers or instruments, musical instruments, this is quite a difficult way to interact with them. So the idea of Semilla comes from a research try to propose different interfaces for interacting with these networks. So the name actually comes from seed in Spanish. It's a double reference. On the one hand, one of the references to use this name of a seed, because these algorithms, generative neural networks, are actually working with randomness. Like the way that you generate a new sound after this algorithm has been trained is that you input a random noise into the network. And then this random noise, you can think about it as a vector or a series of numbers, will correspond to a certain sound output. But this input, this random noise, to fully explore this hidden representation of the network, you need to inject very high dimensional noise vectors. And what does this mean? So like high dimensional in the sense that these networks are working at dimensions of 64 dimensions or 128 dimensions. And to give a perspective is, imagine if you have a synthesizer that has 64 knobs, and each arrangement of this knob that can go from -1 to +1, for example, each one of these parameters, like you have to tune them in such a way to reproduce a certain sound. Obviously, manually, this can be quite difficult to do. So the way that the researchers do it who are working with these AI systems are that they generate these so-called seeds, which essentially a seed is a positive natural number, such as 10, or it can be any number from 0 to 2 to the 32 power, to explore how these networks are generating the sound. So it has this kind of metaphor, right? So you're working with these seeds that are random, pseudo-random number generators. And this on one side. On the other side, I'm very interested in ancient ways of pattern recognition. And one of these, you can consider pattern recognition as something that is trying to predict the future, or you see some types of pattern out of a seemingly random situation to make a decision about the future, right? So this is called prediction. One of these behaviors culturally that humans have in many types of cultures from all over the world is divination. So for example, one of the most popular ones is tarot, where you have these sort of archetypes and from the randomness of how these cards are falling. And obviously the fact that if this is real or it's not real, it's not really the point, but the act of reading patterns from randomness is something very similar to what you do with artificial neural network. Essentially, you're generating random numbers. And then from these random numbers, you're trying to decode the patterns of how these random numbers are making a prediction. So I found that in my research into ancient practices of divination, I found that there is one very specific practice in what is now Oaxaca in Mexico, from the indigenous Mije community, that is decoding or generating a prediction of the future using specifically corn seeds or maize seeds by throwing them in a sort of a space, so like in a cloth, in a square cloth that represents the directions of the world, so like north, south, east, and west. And the way that this type of divination works, this it's called boleomancy, is that the person who wants to know something about the future wants to ask the shaman or the person that is predicting the future. They ask you to choose one of the corn seeds, and this will be you. No, so this will be a representation of yourself in this world. No, so you are represented by this kind, type of corn. And then from this seed, you take approximately 8 to 16 more corn seeds, and then you kind of mix them up and throw them into the cloth, and then see how the arrangements of these seeds fall in the cloth in relationship to yourself, right? So if they fall with the stem up, it means a positive meaning. If they fall like downwards, it has a negative meaning. And if the lower part of the seed is pointing at you, it has another meaning, and so on and so forth. So it's a way to decode some kind of meaning from randomness. And I find this a very poetic way to explore randomness that can also be applied to artificial neural networks, right? Because you are also working with seeds, obviously taking it from this very poetic approach, and actually using this. So I was in Iceland doing this residency project in the Intelligent Instruments Lab, which is a laboratory for the development of musical instruments that use machine learning in their process. And I built a physical version of Semilla, which is this synthesizer that uses a computer vision module, essentially like a small webcam that predicts or looks at this small world space and predicts the positions. So it looks at the positions of the corn and then uses these positions as the vector that I was explaining earlier about to generate a new point in the latent space of the artificial neural network. So I took these very two different approaches to randomness and pattern recognition to create this instrument that in Iceland, there was a small research residency. I was there for a month this year, building this physical instrument that we can link to the video of the process so people can see what it looks like.
You don't consider an academic and you are not part of the academia. So how is your relationship with these residencies and so on?
Yeah, so my background is mostly as a musician, self-taught or autodidact. All the knowledge that I've been in my research has been mostly self-directed. I read a lot of the new papers and research papers that are coming out of academia in the field of artificial intelligence and generative artificial intelligence for sound. I mean, I have a relationship with academia in the sense that the research that I do could be technically positioned within academia, but the approach that I take is a totally non-academic approach. It's more from an artist's perspective. Actually, this residency came about, so I was invited in 2022 to an AI music conference that was part of the Royal Technology Institute of Sweden in Stockholm, where it's a sort of conference slash symposium where a lot of AI researchers in the field of AI music are presenting their new papers and the different insights that have been happening in the field and different artistic projects organized by the researcher Bob L. Strum. At this conference in Stockholm, I met the research director or the director of this lab in Iceland, Thor Magnusson. And I spoke with him and proposed him this research project that I've been developing independently, this Semilla AI project, because I thought it would be this laboratory that he's running in Iceland as it could be a very good platform because it's also focused on building musical instruments. My relationship with academia is like I'm, let's say, adjacent or next to academia, but I'm not really in academia. But I find very interesting that I can be as a kind of bridge between like a more hands-on intuitive approach from the knowledge that is being produced in universities to a more, let's say, like self-directed, independent public, you know, so that can receive this type of information, through my own practice, and that it doesn't necessarily need a PhD research to understand it, or you don't need to be in academia to understand this kind of research. So it speaks to a more general public, and so that's kind of my motivation to bring a lot of the research that is happening in the field of artificial intelligence into a more general context of arts and electronic music that can be sometimes affiliated to academia, but it is not necessarily part of it.
It would be nice to know now about your collaborations and your projects with multidisciplinary artists. And can you tell us a little bit about your recent disc and collaborators, please?
Yeah, one of the perspectives that I had, or one of the questionings that led me to make this new album called Mutualismo, or mutualism. What does it mean for musicians and artists that are living in the so-called age of AI to engage directly with these algorithms using their own music to explore these types of technologies? No, so not really taking from a more general pre-trained algorithm that has been trained by a big company such as a big technology company, but rather how to make these tools more accessible. And the idea was to, so I invited 13 musicians to collaborate on this album, actually work with their own data sets and create, and I created 13 different AI versions of the artists, or like representations of each musician's music into this algorithm. So I had 12 of these different AI algorithms learn from these artists' music styles, and then gave them back all of these models for them to compose. So that was a bit the idea of the album, to actually be a bit more engaged in the production of these types of technologies. And also, one of the particularities of these sound synthesizers using AI is that you can process a pre-existing sound. Let's say if I input my voice into Semilla, And the model that I'm using for this instrument is trained on, let's say, a specific type of music instrument, such as, I don't know, like an arp. My voice would be transformed to this arp sound while keeping the cadence and the style of my voice. But the texture and the tone that would be generated would be an arp sound. So in the process of mutualismo, like, the artists could potentially transform themselves into each other. For example, when I was working in my collaboration for the album and my song and my piece, I used my own model to generate some sounds. So like, this model was trained on like 5 years of my own music. And then I was transforming this music into the style of another producer who was a collaborator called Eli Real 21. Like, the result of the composition was a style of like a blend of my own styles of music and patterns with the sonorities or the textures that this other producer, Eli Real 21, would use in their own productions. So it was an interesting way to think about music making, because then you are not only engaging with your own sonic identity, but you're also engaging with a shared collectivity of sonic identities mediated through this AI algorithm. Yeah, so a bit like this idea was to present what would happen when everybody can potentially transform themselves into each other and create a sort of collective cooperative voice using these technologies.
I want to know if you create the algorithms, all of them, or you use other people's algorithms, or where do you get them?
So I work a lot with open source algorithms. So like, the part of the AI or the neural network architecture for Semilla. So Semilla itself is the interface of how to interact with the algorithm. But the actual algorithm is based on an architecture called a variational autoencoder, which is a type of artificial neural network. And the very specific version of this variational autoencoder was developed at IRCAM, and it's called RAVE, which stands for Real-Time Audio Variational Autoencoder. So this RAVE architecture, which has nothing to do with the sound or the archive, it's just like the neural network, was developed by Antoine Caillon and Philippe Essling at the IRCAM department, which is a department of the IRCAM in Paris that focuses on researching machine learning algorithms, specifically generative algorithms. And I work with a lot of these different open source algorithms and build on them. One thing I really want to point out is that these algorithms or these architectures are essentially building on open source research that has been published over the many years in the field of machine learning. Like, before Semilla is what it is right now, I was already working with my own algorithm, which was also a variational autoencoder called MelSpec VAE. That I created myself, I coded myself. In essence, and it uses these same principles of the seed input, and then you generate an output from the seed. This version of the VAE that was created at IRCAM was just like an improvement that was quite kind of like a non-trivial improvement, in the sense that now this algorithm could generate sound in real time. So now you could use it in a live concert or an installation directly without having to wait some time for the generation to happen, the sound generation to happen, which in the first prototype of Semilla, this was actually a kind of older algorithm that took a little bit of time to generate, and it only generated very short sequences of sound, more like loops and short samples. With RAVE, the particularity is that it generates an infinite stream of audio. And from this infinite stream, you can work with it a bit more like a synthesizer, like a normal synthesizer. So in general, I try to code my own neural networks. But of course, like in this field, a lot of the research is done on previous research done by other researchers. And people just build upon that and get different insights. So one of the improvements, or one of the, yeah, I guess like one another architecture that I built after developing Semilla, and this is an ongoing code repository, was to use the newer algorithms called diffusion denoising probabilistic models, which are a type of artificial neural network that also can generate media. But the process is very different from a variational autoencoder in the sense that essentially diffusion models are the ones responsible for all the new text-to-image algorithms that we've seen. They're gotten very popular, or the text-to-music algorithms. And the way that these algorithms are working is that essentially you have your data set or your archive of sounds, and then through noising process, you iteratively start destroying the sound. So for example, you have a short 3-second sound at the beginning of the step, and then the denoising algorithm, the diffusion algorithm, it starts adding noise onto this sound progressively. So at the first step, it has a little bit of noise, and then the second step, it has more noise until the sound is completely pure noise and it's completely destroyed from the original sound. So that's the first step. The second step is that once you have this destroyed data, you have another algorithm, or actually this is where the artificial neural network happens or does its job, is that the job of the neural network is to denoise this process. So like from the noise, try to generate back the original sound. So it does like an inverse process. So the first process is to destroy the sound with noise until it's pure noise. And then the algorithm, the artificial neural network, undoes this process iteratively. And in this sort of dynamic, which is in the field very informed by diffusion dynamics in liquids or in gases, you have very interesting behaviors compared to variational autoencoder. So you can think about these diffusion algorithms as based on the phenomenon. Let's say you have a glass of water that is clear, and then you put a drop of paint inside this glass of water. And then you start seeing how this paint slowly starts dissolving into the water, and then essentially the water turns like even, so that it turns a specific color. And then the job of the artificial neural network is to go back to the initial point of the drop. So in this case, when you're working with media, you can think about this paint drop into the water as your original image. And of course, because these are algorithms that approximate, they never fully reconstruct the original data. So they only approximate to the original data. The variations that it has in this dynamic are very, very interesting compared to variational autoencoders, where it's just doing an optimization to make the data as similar as possible to the original data. So in this denoising diffusion model, the behavior of the results of once you have it trained is very, it has more, I mean, something that you can describe as it has more creative outputs, because the reconstruction of going back from the noise to the original data, it does a lot more guessing. So in this guessing, you can actually create new sounds or new images or new text using this diffusion process. So one of the algorithms that I built is using this diffusion algorithm and combine it with RAVE, with this other algorithm. So the particularity of this RAVE latent diffusion model that I built myself is to generate more long form music. So it can generate a minimum of 2 minutes of tracks. And if you look at the literature of artificial sound generation, generating a very concise, but at the same time, novel 2-minute track in music is quite heavy, and it's quite a very difficult task. But the idea is that you are using RAVE as some kind of compression algorithm to represent your original sounds into this, again, this latent representation or this compressed representation in the latent space. And then you use a diffusion model to create new hidden representations. So you apply the diffusion process into this latent representation of your sound. And then you basically use the diffusion model as a kind of generator to generate new versions of this compressed representation. And then you just use the decoder of RAVE to generate music back. And because the RAVE architecture compresses the sound by 2048 times, so it's a very compact representation, which allows you to generate very coherent long-form sounds. And this was kind of like an improvement on RAVE, or a kind of like a different technique that you can apply for this algorithm. So in a way, like to sum it up, yeah, I use my own, and I also use open source and other people's algorithms.
this AI generative for sound? Which direction do you think is taking right now?
I personally think that one of the most promising futures is for artists and general public can work with their own data to create new versions or create these kind of ensembles of collectivities in a more cooperative approach. So like this album of Mutualismo was a kind of exercise into generating this social praxis around artificial intelligence and taking into consideration in artificial intelligence as a collective effort rather than thinking about this traditional way of thinking about artificial intelligence as some kind of autonomous entity that you don't have any agency in. Usually because these algorithms are developed on a bigger scale by big companies with a lot of data that you don't even know where it comes from. I actually see the true value of these algorithms when you work with a collectivity, or for example, when you start to analyze, for example, like what if you do a project of like what happens when you analyze the whole styles of music from a whole country with many examples to create some kind of patterns that reflect a lot of these different regionalities, but at the same time, you know where these sounds are kind of coming from. It's a way to work with collective intelligence or collective memory in a disembodied way. So in a way that you work with it through an algorithm and you are working with big bodies of knowledge and collective work and media and art that is highly situated in specific social and cultural contexts. So in my own perspective, this is the more interesting approach that can happen. So I see this as one of the values, no? And also the fact that they can produce ideas or sketches, let's say, to generate new compositions or new images or new art for an artist, especially when an artist is working with their own data and with their own body of work, then it becomes some kind of mirror that you can quickly generate new variations and, you know, build upon that to create new stuff or to just have an analysis into what your own music has been for the past time. On the other side, I see the problem or one of the problematics of these AI systems being applied by big companies or big interests, because the question of labor and the creation of labor is central at this point. It's like essentially artificial intelligence is not a quest for intelligence per se, because we don't really know what intelligence is, but rather a question of labor automation at a very high level. So the fact that you can automate something that in the past took a long, long time is a social, technical, cultural, and economic issue that deals with labor automation. So I see that some of the problems that we're going to start seeing is that you will have these AI systems that on one side, they kind of cheapen the labor or the creation of a song or the creation of an image. It basically drives the value down for human artists, right? Because you can automate this process quite quickly. That's one of the problematics, no? that I'm very critical of. Another of the problems is that the fact that we cannot use our own data sets, or that these data sets on systems like, for example, ChatGPT or other AI systems that are made by big companies, is that you don't really have an understanding of the data that is behind. So this data can contain a lot of biases or cliches and this kind of problematic views of reality of certain cultures, or simply certain cultures don't exist in these types of data sets that are made by companies. So this is some of the problematics or the future that I see in AI, in contrast with the approach that is more centered on the artist and or on the practitioner. So I see that the future of like making art with algorithms is that, yes, you can create new music, so-called new music or variations of existing music at a very high scale and very quickly. And that's why I see this importance into trying to help artists to understand these algorithms better, because, I mean, they're not easy to work with. They're quite complex. And if you're not a computer scientist, it kind of leaves you out of the conversation. So I think there is a lot of work to be done. I mean, the asymmetries of where these algorithms are developed and the data sets that they contain, yeah, as a way to kind of level the playing field for people in different parts of the world. I mean, I see like a positive side to working with AI in the future, but also there's this very negative side that kind of talking about the current system, economical system that we have, it kind of devalues the work of artists. And having artists use these technologies firsthand is a way to kind of subvert that power in a way. At least this is what I think.
take the opportunity to promote what you are doing in Bandcamp and what you want to share with us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, you can find a lot of my music in my Bandcamp. It's on exorcismos.bandcamp.com. Also, if you want to support the Semilla.ai project, you can download it from the website Semilla.ai, which is Semilla.ai. People can donate to the development, with the further development of this software, and make it a bit more accessible. So please, if you can, support an independent artist.
I also want to know, what do you think about what's going to happen with your music using artificial intelligence and the thing that is going on in the world about big data?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, yeah, I think the paradigm of creation is changing. So I see these algorithms as new tools that are very rooted in very specific practices. For example, the fact that you need data to feed these algorithms is a very problematic one, because then the natural thing, to say it in a way, or the intended use, is to kind of extract. So they kind of have this extractive side of them built into them, right? Because you can think about data as the prime resource of that is feeding these algorithms. So in this way, in my practice, I try to remain very, very conscious of this and only work with data there's open source or permitted, and generally not other people's data without their permission. But obviously this is not going to be the case in the future, right? So as these technologies get more and more popular, we're going to have to start thinking about these issues. How do we organize as artists? I don't think every artist will or should be using these technologies if they, yeah, it's just like a new tool. But the thing that every artist should know is that every time you put your music or your images or your text or any kind of digital representation of your work online, this data that belongs to you, or at least that you created, can potentially feed algorithms that you don't know are extracting this data. So I think it's a matter of awareness that I'm also trying to build with my workshops. We got to double think, no? Like every time we put something online, that this is almost certainly going to end up in a data set of some corporation or somebody, even as a single person using this algorithm. Some researchers are building some kind of like watermark. So like, for example, you have a song and then you pass it through an algorithm that kind of adds some kind of noise or some kind of like imperceptible data into your own music. And then when somebody tries to train it after it's been processed with this kind of like adversarial noise, then the training wouldn't really work. They're called data poisoning techniques, where you kind of inject some kind of imperceptible noise that for humans is not perceptible, but for the algorithm is quite destructive. So I think this is one of the preventative measures that we can start taking and thinking about once we are engaging with these types of technologies. Thank you so much for the invitation, Berta, and you'll be happy to share.
We reiterate to you the invitation to follow us along the various episodes of this podcast called Comusic with K, in which we will be introducing our music creations and those of our colleagues. If you want to know more about us, you can visit the website https://comusic.pro or write to us to comusic678@gmail.com. We are looking forward to seeing you over the next episodes.